we go ahead with a gas line, some people think that is going to be the answer, but it's not unless we make it happen.
State lawmakers prepare for tomorrow's start of the 2010 legislative session. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 18th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, concern over a tanker that needed escort tug assistance leaving Valdez.
Having 30-plus-year-old tankers in the system is a concern, and the way to address it is just with watchfulness, since there's no way to get them out of the system under federal law.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Communication Systems, connecting your business and employees to the world through their high-capacity data network. Bandwidth speeds up to 1,000 megabits per second. ACSAlaska.com.
The legislature goes into its annual session tomorrow with a major focus on energy-related issues. Fuel development and supply, as well as taxes, are at the top of the agenda for both parties, although how much eventually gets to the governor's desk is still up in the air. From Juneau, APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Both House and Senate committees held hearings on energy throughout the state since last year's session, on the plan to send North Slope gas to North American markets, on renewable energy projects, and on guaranteeing fuel for Alaskans to use. Combined with a recent upsurge in debate over petroleum tax structure, energy will demand lawmakers' attention this year. House Speaker Mike Chenault says the rest of the session will hinge on two points. Will members be willing to spend the money it'll take, and will they be willing to turn down some of the many alternatives under consideration?
At some point in time, the legislature and the administration or the governor is going to have to stand up and say, we've got to make a move and pick a project if that's what it takes and move forward. Now, you know, will that be a Chacachamna or would that be a Susitna or an in-state gas line? I can't tell you which, but there's too many options out there right now for the legislature to move forward on.
Consideration of taxes stems from Governor Parnell's proposal to make minor changes to the tax regime. Chenault says there's room for movement, and he and other House members do support change, but he's not ready to predict how extensive that change will be.
What we're talking about right now is the economy of Alaska and the people working in Alaska. And because of the time frame that these corporations make their investments on, can Alaska stand around for a year or 2 years before they make a decision on a five-year plan that the industry is going to propose for spending in Alaska? And I don't think that we can.
The Senate is not ready to pick up on that subject, however. President Gary Stevens says lawmakers have time to make good decisions on changes to the tax, and this year is too early. He says the current tax regime went into effect less than 2 years ago, and right now, Alaska is enjoying record-high revenue.
The question is, do we go too far? You know, do we need to look at it and say, well, maybe we're not encouraging development and exploration as much as we should. So that'll be an issue, but I'm not really certain that that'll be an issue decided this legislative session. It's something we've got time on.
House Democrats were a major factor in the votes for the North Slope gas line, energy projects, and the rewrite of the petroleum tax. And there is support among their minority caucus for long-term, reliable, low-cost energy. David Guttenberg of Fairbanks is the minority whip. He says it's all on the table for his members this year. He says Democrats want to see the development of fuel resources that'll take care of Alaskans.
If we go ahead with a gas line, some people think that is going to be the answer, but it's not unless we make it happen. You know, what's going to guarantee that we're going to have gas as equivalent to what Anchorage has now, Cook Inlet has now? What's going to guarantee that this propane distribution points for rural Alaska off of the Yukon or wherever? We have to make that happen.
All members say there are other issues that need consideration. The governor's scholarship program and giving members capital projects in their districts. Those will rise and fall during the next 90 days. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
TV viewers may have noticed some recent late-evening advertisements aimed at men, ads asking men to respect women. Those ads are part of a comprehensive plan by the Parnell administration to reduce the state's epidemic of sexual assault and domestic violence. Today, Alaska Attorney General Dan Sullivan announced three initiatives that the administration will put before the public and state lawmakers this session in an effort to reduce the state's crime rate. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Last month, Governor Parnell announced a 10-year plan to end the state's epidemic of sexual assault and domestic violence. Today, Attorney General Dan Sullivan announced concrete measures aimed at putting that plan into practice. Sullivan introduced the state's first-ever statewide cyber crimes prosecutor. Marika Athens will specialize in the prosecution of internet and computer-aided crimes with a focus on exploitation of children and child pornography. Sullivan credited Senator Liesl McGuire with leadership in advocating legislation for creating the new position. McGuire said her motivation is the state's record of assaults on children.
We have embarrassingly high, dangerous rates of sexual assault. And I no longer want to live in a place where our children are at risk, our women are at risk, and there is a culture that seems to allow this to continue. I want Alaska to be a place that a predator would look to and say, that's the last stop you want to make on your journey. Alaska is not a place you want to go if you are going to sexually assault women and children.
Sullivan said the second part of the initiative is a slate of three bills dealing with criminal justice. The first strengthens sexual assault and domestic violence laws and closes a loophole in Alaska law which allows sex offenders registered in other states to skip registration here. The second bill addresses bail reform, something not attempted in Alaska since the 1960s. Sullivan said current law puts the burden of proof that a perpetrator poses a danger to the community on the state. The bill would change that.
This bill would shift the burden to the defendant. In other words, it would make a presumption that defendants accused of serious crimes such as a felony, sexual assault, are a danger to their community and to the victim. This bill would also make it the law that once convicted of a sexual assault or related felony, perpetrators could not be released pending sentencing or pending an appeal.
The third bill would require retention of DNA evidence and leaves post-conviction DNA testing to the state, not the federal courts, based on a U.S. Supreme Court decision on an Alaska case. The bill also sets up procedures on how a convicted felon can apply for DNA testing.
We also believe it is absolutely necessary and important to provide procedures to enhance the opportunity for fair trials to ensure that true criminals are the ones who are serving time for committing crimes.
The third initiative is in line with Governor Parnell's budget, which has a strong emphasis on criminal justice, according to Sullivan. The bill, if passed, could enable the state to finance a new crime lab.
The bill relating to the crime lab requests authorization from the legislature to issue certificates of participation, which is a debt instrument that will help spread the cost of the crime lab over a specified period of time.
Sullivan says a state-of-the-art crime lab could have a strong effect on fighting sexual assault cases. The new financing scheme would bring the cost of the crime lab down to $75 million from earlier $100 million estimates. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
An Exxon oil tanker that lost power Sunday while leaving Alaska's Prince William Sound is underway again. Coast Guard Lieutenant Herbert Law says the tanker Kodiak departed early this morning from a safe harbor at Knowles Head, where the tugboats had towed the 831-foot vessel. The tanker departed from Port Valdez early Sunday morning but lost power when an aft steam generator overheated. Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council spokesman Stan Jones says these types of incidents are exactly why the RCAC is pushing to preserve the use of escort tugs for tankers.
The reason that they're at risk is the federal law that governs all of this only requires them for single-hull tankers. And within a few years, single-hull tankers will be banned from U.S. waters, and all tankers will have double hulls. And then the question of escorts will be up in the air because federal law is silent on that point.
Jones says last year the Alaska legislature approved a resolution calling for the escorts to continue, and the U.S. House passed the Coast Guard Authorization Act in October with language that would do that.
And now that same measure is before the Senate, and we're doing all we can to get the language included in the Senate version of the Coast Guard bill so that it will end up in the final version, whatever that may be. And we're getting good support from both of our Alaska senators, Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski, and we're highly optimistic that this will make it into the final Coast Guard bill.
Jones says Sunday's problems with the Kodiak are exactly why the tug system needs to continue.
This was a double-hull tanker. It did have a failure on board that could have put it at risk of going aground and causing a repeat of the Exxon Valdez spill, if not something worse. But the tugs were right there, and they did their job in an exemplary fashion.
He says the tugs hooked up to the Kodiak within minutes of being alerted to its power loss. Jones says there are no federal laws that mandate a tanker leave service at a certain age, and the Kodiak is a fully redundant tanker, meaning there is a backup for all necessary systems. But he says the Kodiak was built in 1978 and appears to be the oldest tanker in the system.
Having 30-plus-year-old tankers in the system is a concern, and the way to address it is just with watchfulness, since there's no way to get them out of the system under federal law.
The Kodiak will head to San Francisco to offload its oil, then go to Seattle for repairs. The tanker is carrying about 613,000 barrels, or more than 25 million gallons, of crude oil. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, dealing with more than cold weather during the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race.
I kept seeing four-wheelers and snow machines and trucks and cars all going in a different direction and all going driving on the trail.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race wrapped up last night with John Baker of Kotzebue finishing first. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
Baker crossed the finish line at 6:26 p.m., having started the race almost exactly 2 days earlier. He said the glare ice and 65 below wind chills this year did not faze his team that much.
It's just what it is, and we just have to go through it. I didn't mind.
Baker beat out Martin Boozer and Lance Mackey, who finished in second and third places, respectively. Last year's champion, Mitch Seavey, scratched the race early on after he lost the trail for over an hour and suffered frostbite in his eyes. The K300 took a different route this year, staying on the Kuskokwim River for all of the 320 miles. Parts of the river were entirely glare ice, and other parts were a thin layer of snow that greatly resembled ice. But Tough Trail is just the reputation that the K300 race has among veteran mushers like Baker.
As far as the mushing, this is the type of races that we've been working for 15 years to be able to compete in and to win, so it's a real huge sense of accomplishment for me.
Martin Boozer came in 1 hour and 23 minutes behind Baker. Boozer is a K300 regular, but he said the race never gets old.
Well, it's the land of surreal, you know. This is Bethel. This is pretty unreal. It's always a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Boozer was banged up a little bit over the hardened trail. He said there seemed to be more than one trail at times.
I kept seeing four-wheelers and snow machines and trucks and cars all going in a different direction and all going driving on the trail.
Boozer passed Lance Mackey with about 30 miles left in the race. Mackey was chasing his first Kuskokwim 300 title, but he says the trail got the best of him.
I had like a 45-minute lead on these guys at one point. I stayed an extra 45 minutes up in wherever that place is, Antioch. Left, right with them guys, and then I got off the trail and It's the way it goes. It's part of racing.
Mackey says his goal now is to become the first ever racer to win 4 Iditarods in a row. And after this year's Cusco, he says he feels as confident as ever.
This is going to be a damn tough team to beat in an Iditarod again, you know. This is a warm-up. I wanted to see what they were made of, and they far exceeded my expectations. So.
13 mushers started the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race on Friday night. I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Over the weekend, Yukoners took home the two biggest trophies from the Alcan 200 snow machine race outside of Haines. It was the 41st running of the annual event and brought 28 riders from around Alaska and Canada to the eastern border of the Kluane National Park Reserve. Tara Bicknell has more from KHNS in Haines.
Dev Hurlburt and Jason Adams of Whitehorse and Fairbanks Colby Hill were the first three to finish the 145-mile snow machine race. In conditions some racers called the worst they've ever seen. Riders took off from the U.S.-Canada border at 10 a.m. Saturday, hitting speeds of over 100 miles an hour as they reached Desdiash Lake in the Yukon, where racers turned their sleds south for the return trip to the finish line. Hurlburt finished first overall in 1 hour, 19 minutes, and 4 seconds.
First place, guess who? Dev Hurlburt.
Hurlburt's raced the Alcan 200 15 times before, taking home almost every top spot besides first overall.
I got 4 seconds and 3 thirds. I won the open class 1 year, but yeah, this is my first overall. So I have lots of little trophies.
Yeah.
No big ones.
Yeah.
Finishing less than a minute and a half later was Jason Adams from Whitehorse. The two riders said they raced close to each other throughout the race, with Adams clocking the lead by less than a minute at the halfway point.
Started in the back. I had to get to the front.
Of our class, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we started in the front of the pack type of deal, but which is a good thing, I think. We raced briefly.
Yeah.
For probably a minute, maybe.
Yeah.
About that.
Each way.
Times were slower overall this year, but weather conditions called for it. Adam said racers faced 4-foot snowdrifts and high winds during the chase. The Chilkat Snowburners honored Jeffrey Petey, who died racing the Alcan 200 in 2009. His wife, Tracy Petey, accepted 2 gifts from race organizer Karen Hess, including Petey's retired racing bib.
We, the Snowburners, actually want to give you something, and the first thing we're going to give you is, this is retired.
Yes, thank you.
And it is number 97.
Right on.
So, also, because we love you so much and we got to know you over the past year, because we never knew you before, you have a jacket now from the Chilkat Snowburners with Jeff's number on the sleeve.
Thank you.
And we love you.
Thank you.
In Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
Barb Egayak witnessed a turning point for education in rural Alaska. The president of the National Education Association Alaska did her student teaching in Tinunek, west of Bethel. High schools were just starting to be built in the villages, so rural students didn't have to leave home to attend boarding school after 8th grade. And Egayak taught in rural schools for more than 2 decades. We invited her to the APRN studios to talk about her experiences and her vision for education in Alaska as part of our occasional series on Native education. She says she saw big changes in communities as their high schools opened up.
That meant a huge difference for families in rural Alaska because kids could stay in their own home communities and be able to go to school. My husband and his siblings, except for the very, very youngest, all had to go away from home for high school. So that was a huge difference. There have been a lot of changes, and I think improvements in terms of making sure that the standards that exist for kids in larger communities, in urban communities, are the same as what we offer to kids in rural Alaska.
And how about an assessment of the public schools in Alaska and the work that they're doing as far as serving Native students? Do you think that they do enough?
For the most part, I think districts are doing what they can to assist in our Native communities and assist Native students. It's difficult, though. We're imposed upon with federal regulations and things that don't really fit for our Indigenous students in terms of how they learn, what methods work best for them. A standardized test cannot possibly help really portray what many of our Indigenous students understand and know about.
And would you say those are some of the areas that the schools fall short as far as that level of understanding of the needs, perhaps the cultural needs of students? Where are the schools falling short?
I think it's trying to achieve a balance between what regulations say they must do and trying to achieve what the goals of the community are. In places where we have tried to achieve real community schools and real involvement of people in that community, the more involvement there is, the better achievement we're seeing and the more success that those schools are able to come up with. But it's not an easy balance.
And with that in mind, communities having involvement in developing school programs, how do you envision something like that being carried forward? It seems like it could be a bit unwieldy to have different communities with different needs and different philosophies on what education should be impacting how education is put forth. How do you see that happening?
Well, I think it is... One area where we can do more is to involve more community members into what is happening in schools. And we have to keep in mind that many adults in our communities are not comfortable going into schools. Either they had a negative experience or they don't feel welcome or they don't feel comfortable coming into the school community. So the more we can do to invite them in positive experience kinds of ways, the more comfort level they will achieve and then be more interested in coming in to serve on a committee or to participate in school activities where decision making is happening.
Teacher retention in rural Alaska has been a chronic problem. People cycle in and out. What do you think can be done to address that? How can we get teachers to stay in a community and be invested there?
We have to value the work that they do by supporting them, by providing them with the knowledge they need in terms of professional development. We have to provide them with salaries and compensation packages that makes sense considering the cost of being in a rural, remote area. We have to provide them with a reliable retirement system. We have new teachers coming in now who do not have that and can't look forward to a comfortable retirement. We also have to make sure that rural teacher housing is dealt with in a way that provides something that is safe and warm. And we have to be careful to make sure that they also have good understanding of the community that they're working in. So there has to be training for them. There has to be support to help them understand the culture of the community that they're living in.
Barb Ngaiak is president of the National Education Association, Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Frontier Airlines will be getting into the Fairbanks summer market, and that prospect is having a downward impact on ticket prices between the interior city and lower 48 destinations. Alaska travel industry analyst Scott McMurrin says the Denver-based carrier has sparked competition.
Anytime airlines are mad at each other, the consumer wins. That's a key concept in a competitive airline environment, something which Fairbanksans have not seen for some time.
McMurrin says Frontier has shaken up the Fairbanks market by offering discounted fares for the Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday schedule it will fly this summer. He says the ticket prices are half the going rates in some cases.
Less than $400 round trip from Fairbanks to Denver. The San Diego fare is good, $556. In fact, San Diego, Albuquerque, Omaha, all of those are within, $550, which compares with over $900 before Frontier started. So it's just crazy.
McMurrin says Alaska Airlines, Delta, and Northwest Airlines are responding with fares to compete with Frontier. He says some of those are available for current travel months before Frontier starts its Fairbanks service. The extreme cold weather that gripped much of the Northern Territory last week also meant the Alaska military had to be called in for a rescue on the Porcupine River. Richard Carroll's family was stranded by the cold weather near the Yukon-Alaska border after he left to get a prescription refilled for his daughter. As the CBC's Leonard Linklater reports, Mr. Carroll is a little embarrassed by early reports of the incident.
Richard Carroll Jr. is a proud man.
We've been trapping up there since 1976, the first time we ever asked for help.
Carroll's daughter was visiting them on the trap line last week. The 28-year-old has a chronic back problem and needed more pain medication. He drove over 200 kilometers by snow machine to a nearby community and flew to Fairbanks to get it refilled. Then the mercury dropped to below minus 50 Celsius. Carroll was not worried about his family surviving because he knew they were in good hands.
My wife is she's no greenhorn. She'd once spent 9 months out, left in the fall time and came back with a riverboat.
But his daughter was immobilized and in pain without the medicine, so he called the military.
Well, we're definitely thankful for the military. And there was no questions asked. They seemed very helpful.
They flew his family to Fairbanks, where his daughter was treated and is doing fine now. Carroll says what embarrassed him were early reports that his family was stuck without wood or water. He says that is just not true. Leonard Linklater, a White Horse.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Tara Bicknell in Haines, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and the CBC's Leonard Linklater in Whitehorse. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.